Hi, this is Damien from New City, Orlando. You're listening to our CBR Bible Project series, where each episode we introduce a different book of the Bible as it coincides with CBR. To learn more about Community Bible Reading, or CBR, visit newcityorlando.com/CBR.
Hey, New City, this is Nate Claiborne, and I'm here with Josh Kessler today, and we're kind of finishing up our conversation from last time we were together, talking about Nehemiah today, as we talked about Ezra in our previous time. But it's good to be with you today, Josh.
It's good to be here, man. Yeah, I love this. This is awesome.
So part two, in some sense, we Josh and I were talking about this earlier before we got on the podcast, where we really could have done Ezra and Nehemiah together as a single podcast. They're a single book in Hebrew Bibles. And then I was looking through the resources to put in the show notes, noticed pretty much all the commentaries, videos, things that we would point you to dealt with Ezra and Nehemiah together.
Yeah.
But we decided to split them and do two separate podcasts, in part so that we could focus on Ezra kind of as a person and what his role was in one podcast. And now we're going to focus on Nehemiah and what his role is in this kind of continuing story from where we were last time.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think it'd be a great opportunity then to sort of dive into Nehemiah as a person, maybe his character and some of the traits that he shares with other types in the Bible.
Yeah.
It's interesting because we don't really know a whole lot about Nehemiah other than what the book presents for us.
Yeah.
So he was probably part of the diaspora and somehow within the context of the Babylonian Empire, he was able to rise to prominence in the king's court. And so we know from the book itself that he becomes the cupbearer at the end of chapter one. So he has direct access to the king in a very influential way. So that's something unique about him.
And maybe without getting too far into the weeds on this, we could point out the cupbearer is a very trusted. It's not just like the king's favorite servant. He's literally taste testing.
He's making sure the king doesn't get poisoned. Right. He is tasting everything before the king gets to it, so that essentially if somebody were to try to assassinate the king that way,
it kills the cupbearer first. So in some sense, it's a coveted role in that you have access to royalty power. In another sense, it's maybe not a coveted role that you would aspire to. Like,
that's right.
You're going to be the guy who dies if someone
I.e. Joseph.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Yeah.
So we see Nehemiah, and it also just sort of drops us, as we start off in the beginning of Nehemiah, just drops us right into the action, which is another clue that we're still kind of in the same storyline that starts in Ezra, but it does shift the perspective. And I think that's why there's some in English Bibles, they split them into two books. Cause if you all noticed as we were reading through Ezra, a lot of it's talking about what's going on. And then at certain points it shifts into first person.
Whereas
at the beginning of Nehemiah, just right off the bat, very first thing, the words of Nehemiah, and then the story drops you into the story. And we get a lot of first person perspective of what Nehemiah felt, what he was doing. We get a prayer.
Yeah.
We even get some internal monologue, like, which we'll get to in the minute. It's interesting that we brought up the cupbearer thing. It's kind of the punchline of chapter one.
Like
you don't really know what's up with this Nehemiah guy. He prays to God. We'll read through that prayer here in a minute. And then at the end, at this time, I was the king's cupbearer. And you're like, oh.
It's like a cliffhanger almost leading you into chapter two, which is really interesting.
Yeah. So you mentioned a minute ago, we were talking about types and connections. Do you want to elaborate on that? Like how Nehemiah connects to some other characters?
Yeah. And I think we'll see this as you read the prayer. But I think that there's so much resonance here with David, just as a person and as a character. The passion with which Nehemiah prays and the desire to see God's name be made great in Israel, the way that he mourns and weeps over the brokenness of the city and over the malpractice with the poor and the widow, the way that he describes those things, there's so much resonance with the Psalms, I think, just as you read through the prayer. And so maybe that'd be a great lead-in.
Let's pick it up. We'll read through all of chapter one, and then I can make some comments at the beginning of chapter two, because we can't just stop at the end.
Right.
But after it says, these are the words of Nehemiah, it says, during the month of Chislev in the 20th year, when I was in the fortress city of Susa, Hanani, one of my brothers, arrived with men from Judah, and I questioned them about Jerusalem and the Jewish remnant that had survived the exile. And they said to me, the remnant in the province who survived the exile are in great trouble and disgrace. Jerusalem's walls have been broken down and its gates have been burned. When I heard these words, I sat down and wept. I mourned for a number of days, fasting and praying before the God of heavens. I said, and then here's the prayer, Lord, the God of heavens, the great and awe-inspiring God who keeps his gracious covenant with those who love him and keeps his commands, let your eyes be open and your ears be attentive to hear your servant's prayer that I now pray to you day and night for your servants, the Israelites. I confess the sins we have committed against you. Both I and my father's family have sinned. We have acted corruptly towards you and have not kept the commands, statutes, and ordinance you gave your servant Moses. Please remember what you commanded your servant Moses. If you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the peoples. But if you return to me and carefully observe my commands, even though your exiles were banished to the farthest horizon, I will gather them from there and bring them to the place where I chose to have my name dwell. They are your servants and your people. You redeemed them by your great power and strong hand. Please, Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and to that of your servants who delight to revere your name. Give your servant success today and grant him compassion in the presence of this man. And if you just stopped right there, you don't know who this man is. And then mm-hmm. with the next words, he says, at that time, I was the king's cupbearer. And so mm-hmm. you immediately know, okay, something's about to happen.
Yeah.
And I'll read just a little bit farther and then we can kind of comment on it.
Yeah.
The beginning of chapter 2, it says, during the month of Nisan in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was set before him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. I had never been sad in his presence. So the king said to me, why do you look so sad when you aren't sick? This is nothing but sadness of heart. It's very perceptive on the king's part. Mm-hmm. I was overwhelmed with fear and replied to the king, may the king live forever. Why should I not be sad when the city where my ancestors are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire? Then the king asked me, what is your request? So I prayed to the God of heavens and answered the king, if it pleases the king and if your servant has found favor with you, send me to Judah and to the city where my ancestors are buried so that I may rebuild it. The king, with the queen seated beside him, asked me, how long will your journey take and when will you return? So I gave him a definite time and it pleased the king to send me. I'll kind of pause right there. If we work backwards a little bit, we see two different types of prayers from Nehemiah. This kind of recurs throughout the book. We've got Nehemiah praying in an extended first-person sense.
Yeah.
And then we have this, where I just read a few verses back, the king asks him a question, and then he says, so he prayed to the God of heavens and answered the king.
Yeah.
So obviously, that's a in-the-moment, under-your-breath, quick request, and then answer. He didn't stop and pause and kneel and pray. And so it was kind of a, I think you mentioned this earlier when we were talking off air about like, this is kind of what is maybe being alluded to with this idea of pray without ceasing of just in the moments throughout the day. It doesn't have to be a stop and pause and everything is focused on praying at the moment. He's just kind of praying on the fly because, the things that are not mentioned here, just to give some cultural background, when he shows up in front of the king sad, the king could have just had him put to death.
Yeah.
Because if you were in a bad mood, you did not show it in front of the king. So the king, you can see the king likes him by the fact that he inquires, he knows Nehemiah, he's able to sense its sadness of heart.
Yeah. And we know that he has favor with the king. If we read on just the end of that paragraph, says, and the king granted me what I asked, for the good hand of my God was upon me.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously God was working in this whole situation.
Yeah. And that's a theme we're seeing through Ezra, Nehemiah, and we'll see it in Esther as well, of they're showing God's providence rather than telling us about God's providence.
Yeah.
Editorially, he kind of says it right there. But in the moment, for the king to, one, not put him to death, two, to seem genuinely interested in what's going on, to then three, Nehemiah feeling the courage to just ask this king for a very radical request.
Yeah.
And for the king to just follow up with, just give me some more details.
Right.
Not how can I let my trusted cupbearer go halfway across the world to be with his people? Mm-hmm. Just what do you need? Which would, I mean, there's no way I think Nehemiah expected in the moment the king would be as receptive.
No.
And so that's why he knows later to say, the king granted because God's gracious hand was on me. And so he's seeing God at work in these mundane, well, not really mundane, kind of supercharged, stressful moments.
Right, yeah. And I think Nehemiah is giving us a pattern, at the beginning with that very long, extended personal prayer, and then the in-the-moment prayer, and saying that God clearly responds as we pray, that he is not only attentive, but he longs and waits for us to pray for these things that we need, that we desire, and that he does, in fact, respond.
Mm-hmm.
And he's faithful to incline his ear toward us. And so I think there's a great pattern in that for us just in these first couple of chapters.
Yeah, and if we go back a little bit even to that, the longer prayer, we kind of see it connects us back in some sense to Nehemiah is a kind of Moses in a way. I mean, there's some similarities, some differences, but he's explicitly drawing on the story of the Israelites in the Pentateuch and of the way God worked through Moses. Mm-hmm. He's going back to the land and is going to help rebuild things, mm-hmm. as we'll read on throughout the book. In some sense, Moses is like the first main figure that we get a personal look at for an extended period of time. I guess you have Abraham through Genesis, but Moses ends up being the focal point. Really, Exodus through Deuteronomy.
Yeah.
And then David is a focal point. And now we're getting these late in the history of Israel leader for first person focal points with Ezra and now with Nehemiah.
That's right. Yeah.
Now, if we look a little bit farther, so he gets, the king grants him his request. He sees mm-hmm. God at work. He gets sent back to start the rebuilding process. It is, as you might imagine, not a piece of cake.
Right.
or there wouldn't really be the rest of the book of Nehemiah to read through.
And Ezra has set up that pattern for us.
Right.
There's this opposition. And
yeah. Things are not going to be smooth sailing. So
exactly.
they go back. We won't go blow by blow through their rebuilding of the various gates and of the of the wall.
Right.
By the time we get to chapter 4, there's kind of a coalition of opposition up against them that don't want them to get things rebuilt.
Right.
You can, if we imagine for a moment, in the ancient world, it may be a little bit difficult for the king of Persia, who's halfway across the world, who gave you permission to be doing what you're doing, but then you show back up and it's not like they can just pick up the phone and call. And even if you're going to send a letter, we're talking about weeks,
right?
If not months lapsing between communication.
Yep.
So he's dealing with that. I'm struck by the picture of when he ends up on building the wall while he's carrying his sword. That whole idea of like there's work to be done, but we're also having to fight off opposition. It's kind of, I think it gets co-opted not in a negative way, but for church leadership in the sense of you're doing the work of the ministry, but then there's also the world that you're up against, and there's sometimes opposition from within, sometimes opposition from without, and you've got to a lot of times be doing two things at once.
Yeah. It's a great picture of being aware, being on guard. And we take that obviously nowadays in the very spiritual sense, being on guard, continually thinking about how to protect the sheep, how to protect leadership. Those things are very important, and I think Nehemiah gives us a little bit of that there, in that picture where they're building and they're ready to fight at any time if enemies come. They're not seeking it out. But they're ready to defend.
Yeah. They know what God has called them to. They can see God's hand at work. That's why they got permission to be there. Mm-hmm. This is the Lord's people. This is the Lord's people's city. It needs to be rebuilt. It needs to be back in business, so to speak, with the temple up and running and all of these other things.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we're dealing with that outside opposition. But then we still get some of these threads that we had in Ezra, and we were talking about this a bit ago, of the people are filtering back into the land. And in some sense, we don't have the idolatry issue anymore. The people followed the idols of the Canaanites, and they kind of are realizing they got sent into exile for that as one of their failures. They seem to be struggling with, well, the other two reasons you were sent to exile, according to the prophets, were religious ritualism and social injustice. And so you're not taking care of the widow and the orphan, and you're just kind of going through the motions.
Empty sacrifices,
not taking stuff seriously. And so they get back in the land. We don't see any hint of them wanting to follow the Canaanite gods anymore, but we still see the two other issues really in the forefront in these books. So what do we see as we look through here in Nehemiah?
Yeah, we really do. And I think so. Nehemiah's part of his goal is as trying to being so passionate about sort of reestablishing God's name first and foremost amongst his people. Begins obviously the repair of the wall. That's a huge part of just raising morale for God's people in general. But then he gets really practical, and so when we get to chapter 8, Ezra comes back on the scene actually, and reads the law, and so there's this sort of this this covenant renewal ceremony that happens, and that Nehemiah leads the charge in to say that if we are going to flourish, we have got to look more like what God has called us to look like. And that's a people who take care of the widow and take care of the poor. That's a people who are concerned for God's temple and to continually be seeking holiness as we reinstitute this covenant ceremony, and we seek to follow after God again with our whole heart. Really, I think that's his desire, and I think, as I mentioned earlier, you see that in his prayers, that his desire is that God's name would be made great and that his people would flourish. And so, yeah, you've in 8 through, I think, 10, 11-ish, that's the whole covenant renewal ceremony that happens and takes place. And then Nehemiah goes back to the king. So he's a governor for a little while, this period of reform. Then he leaves, goes back to the Persian king. And while he's gone, everything sort of falls apart again and falls out. All the work that he did seems to be somewhat undone as we come to the end of the book in chapter 13, when he comes back as a second time to govern the people. He sees all of this stuff happening that, like, is shocking to him based on what he had done previously and all the covenant renewal that had happened in those previous chapters. He sees, you know, people, marketplaces up near the walls and the temple, and people have intermarried again, and there's all of this stuff that seems to be undone from what he had previously sought to establish. And so it's this, there's this juxtaposition, and as we said earlier, between God being faithful to keep his promises, and we see that in bits and pieces with the reform, and again in Ezra, as we saw with the rebuilding and with the temple dedication, but there's also this clear need and this clear message. And I think this is the message of the book and really of the Old Testament in general. The overarching message and from the prophets is this, that if we're ever going to be the people that God has called us to be and wants us to be, there has to be a holistic transformation of our hearts. And that is what we're missing. So we see that in the very nature of having to come back and reform again. So had there been a real true heart change, there probably wouldn't have been this need to come and essentially reform everything that had already been reformed once before.
Yeah.
And I think even Hebrews gives us a great picture of that, the old covenant and the picture of the old covenant, that the nature of it was temporary. That it wasn't, that it wasn't going to be this permanent lasting change. The nature of having to sacrifice every year to atone for the sins of the people pointed to the very need for something greater,
mm-hmm.
An eternal forever sacrifice. And in juxtaposition with that, the nature of our sinful hearts being that that's how we're going to change, is we need a holistic heart transformation.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, the great message of Ezra and Nehemiah. I think that's the great message of the Old Testament as we look forward to this king, this forever king and this savior that will, in fact, do that. Write the law of God, not just in our minds, but in our hearts.
Mm-hmm.
Jeremiah 31. So,
I think to that point, it's Ezra and Nehemiah, as we're reading it in the Old Testament, feels like it's kind of right in the middle, but it's really a great segue for the gospel.
It is.
The gospel as a whole, but even just the gospels as writings.
Right.
We kind of are like the spiritual climate that Jesus runs into in the gospels is very similar to the spiritual climate we see on the backside of the exile in Ezra and Nehemiah.
It is.
Stuff's rebuilt and things are functioning, but the people are very half-hearted and they didn't learn their lesson.
Yeah, and I think Nehemiah also clues us into there are seeds of Pharisaism that we see planted when we realize that the true need is a heart transformation. So we can reform all day long and we can do that all we want. But if there isn't a holistic heart transformation that takes place along with that, what's going to happen is exactly what we see in the New Testament, which is Pharisaism is rampant, right? And so much so that the Pharisees have put together this, help me with the name of it, but it's essentially, it's all extraneous material on covenant and law, but it's like their elder code that they've come up with.
They're so concerned with not breaking the letter of certain laws that they've added laws on top of. I think we do a thing on Sunday mornings we call fencing the table. Mm-hmm. But they did a thing called fencing the Torah, where they're sort of building a fence around, just in case, just so that you can't break these rules. Here's four other rules that mm-hmm. if you don't break those rules, then you won't actually break this other rule. But then it just is an endless regress of the stuff that Jesus runs into in the Gospels, where they're worried mm-hmm. about like how far you can walk on the Sabbath or things like that. Like is healing this man telling him to pick up his mat and walk? Oh, you can't do that because if he picks up his mat, that's working on the Sabbath. And just totally missing the like, but I just healed this man from his sickness and his infirmity.
Yeah, missing the entire nature of the new covenant and everything that Jesus has come to bring, in that the point is doing good on the Sabbath,
mm-hmm.
right? The point is not that we're so concerned about the very letter of the law that we miss the entire message of Jesus and what he's come to bring. And that's that as we look to him, the perfect and the only one who could ever fulfill all of these laws in the covenant in faith, that our hearts become more and more like his, and that we become changed, not only to desire to do those things that he's called us to do, but we actually start doing them.
Yeah. And I think Nehemiah gives us a good picture of why we need that and mm-hmm. sets us up for seeing that more in the New Testament. So it's, I guess, our hope as people are reading through Nehemiah, and even as we get into some of these themes will come up again in Esther as well.
Yeah.
Is this, we're in this historical section of the Old Testament, that it will stir up this desire for heart change for us, just realization that it's work the Spirit has to do within us. It's not if we just get the right system, it'll fix everything. It's a, it's not anti-system, it's not anti-work, but it is realizing that those are not the only things necessary, and in maybe some cases not the most important thing.
And to recall the picture of the wall, of having, we can use the sword for a spiritual metaphor, of having the sword ready with us in all times, but also just carrying on with our work, the daily work that God has called us to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so both things happen and both things are important. So we continue to go about our day. We continue to work and ask God to bless the work of our hands, but we are ready at any moment to pray. to pray without ceasing. We're ready at any moment to stop exactly what we're doing and be attentive to the Spirit of God and listen and be aware of what He is, how He is moving and what He's doing.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, especially true in the current climate that we find ourselves in. Mm-hmm. So,
most definitely. Well, yeah. It's been good to chat with Nehemiah with you.
Yeah.
I look forward to next time.
It's been really good. Thanks, Nate. Yeah.